So, who has the first question? At the back there, Anne?
Thank you very much. It was a very informative speech, which we enjoyed. But to a certain extent, you've missed the most fundamental question that I think is on the minds of most of the people here. Addressing the logic, the actual logic of release or potential release at the one-third point. For instance, we know that in the U.S., these types of releases come at about 90%. And when people are sentenced to jail, it's the sense of the court, it's the sense of the jurors, that they really are sending that man away for 12 years who murdered those three little girls and the grandfather. And most of us here are quite disturbed to realize that he's eligible to walk the streets on day parole after one-third of his sentence. So is it a question of the law, or is it regulations that allow that?
It's the law. It's in the Corrections and Conditional Release Act. And as I mentioned, it is, people are, offenders are eligible to apply for day parole. Full parole is reviewed at one-third. Very few apply for day parole, and full parole, as I mentioned, they don't serve, or they serve much more than that eligibility period. So when they're eligible to apply at 33% of their sentence is served, they're actually, before they're being released, they've served almost 50% of their sentence. But they're all eligible to apply at one-third.
Sorry, could you use the mic because we're recording this?
Yeah. I think the fundamental issue here, ma'am, is that you wonder why 60 to 70% of the population, and those are your figures that you gave, have little or no confidence in the parole board. I would suggest to you that that is the very basic reason why 60 to 70% of us have little confidence in the parole board when we see the releases coming at the one-third point.
But that's my point. They don't come at the one-third point.
Well, you perceive it that way, but we in the public don't perceive it that way. We perceive day parole as the end of the sentence. Now, you consider it not to be, but that's why 60 to 70% of the population has little or no confidence. Thank you.
One of the difficult considerations in reintegrating a person into their community is to get a proper job. And obviously that's very successful, but I would think employers have some difficulty with that. What is the role of the parole board in seeing that that happens, and why is it so successful?
In seeing that someone can seek employment? Well, the parole board actually is not responsible for ensuring that they have employment, but it certainly works to an offender's advantage if they can say at their parole hearing that they have a job lined up. In fact, the work of giving offenders some trades, some employability skills is predominantly the work of the Correctional Service of Canada. And then when they're on released, the parole officers actually work for the Correctional Service of Canada. And they would be supervising and helping. There's employment counselors that the Correctional Service of Canada has in each and every parole office across the country, and they would work to help that offender find employment.
Recently, we've been treated to observations on the American election system. there are still quite a few states that seem to me are vindictive in that released prisoners don't have voting rights. Do we have any limitations in Ontario in particular and in Canada in this area?
You know, I'm not sure about provincial levels, but we had a Supreme Court decision a number of years ago. It was a decision that took 18 years in the making by a man named Rick Sauve, who worked hard to get the vote for inmates, and now inmates, at least in the federal system, have the right to vote. Not that they all vote. I think the turnout is quite low, but it's part of that responsibility of being a citizen and trying to engage offenders in their in that responsibility of law-abiding behavior. But unfortunately, yes, they have the right to vote at the federal level, but they don't often exercise that right.
We have a question over here.
Ms. Oates, it's been well established that, and as you've mentioned, that Indigenous inmates make up a disproportionate number of people within the federal system, about 30% among men and much higher even among women. And the latest statistics in the Correctional Investigators Report have put that at an all-time high. I understand that the statistics also show that Indigenous offenders are less likely to get before the board when their parole eligibility dates come up, and there are fewer of them proportionately that are actually released on parole. What is the board doing? Now, you mentioned elder offenders, or rather elder-assisted hearings. Those have been going on for some time. Obviously, they haven't had much of an effect on the statistics. What other efforts is the board taking to ensure that Indigenous offenders are getting before the board in some sort of a timely manner when their eligibility dates come up, and that once they are, and if they are released into the community, what efforts are your workers and your parole officers in the community doing to ensure they can remain in the community and not be revoked?
Ooh, good question. Tough question. First of all, elder-assisted hearings, yes, we've had them for a long time. They weren't used very often, particularly during a tough period of crime control in this country, but we've had a 40% increase of the use of elder-assisted hearings in the last few years, which I think is phenomenal. We have an inReach program now to an inReach in terms of going to Indigenous communities, going into our federal penitentiaries to talk about elder-assisted hearings to promote their use. The fact of the matter is that a high number of Indigenous offenders waive or decline to have a parole hearing. So we're not even seeing them. So we're working with the Correctional Service of Canada now to try to figure out ways to encourage Indigenous offenders to come before the board. But it's not that we're denying. It's that they're not even coming to the board for hearings. So that's something we're working on now with CSC to try and encourage more Indigenous offenders to actually apply for parole. And I just wanted to say something. In terms of what are we doing out in the community, the parole officers don't report to me. They actually report to the Correctional Service of Canada. We are actually engaging with the Correctional Service of Canada to have some more time, I would say, with the parole officers over the next year, to talk about some of our expectations, some of our concerns, and that would include the whole Indigenous offender issue.
I'd like to address a specific issue which occurred recently, and that was this woman, I believe her name was McClintock, who was imprisoned for 25 years for the slaying of an 8-year-old girl, and who was transferred to an indigenous healing lodge. And then she was transferred back again to regular prison due to public outrage. So I'd like to ask two questions. Firstly, was that decision made by the parole board to transfer? And if whether it was or it wasn't, if you have any personal opinions on it? I mean,
Transfer, the parole board didn't have anything to do with
okay.
That comes under the Correctional Service of Canada authority, so uh-huh. No, we didn't have any involvement at all with that particular case. In terms of my personal, I'm also a good public servant, but I think what we have to think about, and I mention it in terms of our polarizing ideologies, you know, you're either soft on crime or you're tough on crime, or you're either, you know, a loser, you're a con, you're an addict, we have to come up with different words. Words matter, I think. And we have to stop grouping people into little groups. We talk about corrections and in the parole board that risk, it's individualized. It's no one steals that one thing for the same reason. You know, you steal a whole pile of groceries. Is it because your kids are hungry, or is it because you just want to be an idiot, or a joyride, or something? You know, so the risk for that same crime, the risk that someone poses, may be really quite different. But as soon as we start putting people into groups, and then having policy and laws for specific groups, we run a risk that we're going to lose a lot of people in the course of doing that. Does that make sense?
Well, because the woman was indigenous, because these healing lodges apparently accept both indigenous and non-indigenous. Oh, sorry.
Hold the mic this way.
Oh sorry. Apparently these healing lodges accept people who are both indigenous and non-indigenous background. So she wasn't being singled out. I mean, there was a claim that was made, a mistake was made. What kind of mistake? Was it a clerical error, or was it a failure of moral judgment? I just wonder
yeah.
what your personal opinion is. Because she committed a horrible crime, but my personal opinion is she should have been allowed to stay there. And she should not have been sent back due to a public outcry, because that's a political decision. It has nothing to do with the individual merits of the case.
Agreed.
Yeah. So, do you have any opinions on that, or I guess, okay. Maybe that's not fair to ask, but anyway. It's a very controversial issue. But anyway.
And we have someone, yes, next.
I have a question about statistics. And I can understand if you have an offender who's up for parole who has previously been employed, whether it's white collar, blue collar. What I'm curious about is whether you have any statistics on the number or percentage of people who are able to be rehabilitated because they've had a previous job, a previous life, a group or community they belong to, versus people that have never had the benefit of that experience to start with.
I don't have we can probably find statistics on that. I don't have them, but the large amount of people in our prison have come from poor backgrounds, poor education, low employment, lots of abuse, lots of addictions. So I would probably hazard a guess to say that the vast majority of people in prison do not have good employability skills and have not had stable employment throughout their life. I know I can say that quite strongly with the women offenders. They have an extremely low employability history compared to male offenders, but I would expect that male offenders would be low as well.
Over here, Anne.
This is another one of those Canada versus U.S. questions. In at least some parts of the U.S., people who are released on parole are expected to pay rent on an ankle bracelet and a fee to their parole officer. Is any of this true in Canada?
Not that I am aware. I know that electronic monitoring is being used by some provinces, and certainly the federal system has some kind of electronic monitoring system in place, but offenders are not expected to pay.
Thank you. I just want to ask about mental health, offenders and mental health, and I know they also are disproportionately represented within the system. I also know I work in mental health in the public sector, and we have less and less resources, so I know often conditions are that they get treatment, but there really isn't treatment available. I know court ordered is somewhat different from the public system, so I'm just wondering if you could address that.
Yeah. You know, I think back in the 60s when they decided that, you know, we should deinstitutionalize the mentally ill and have all these wonderful programs in the community, which made a lot of sense, except they forgot to put the resources in the community. And what's happened is that we have criminalized the mentally ill, and the federal prison system has become de facto the mental health system for this country, which is really quite appalling. So we have, I think the Correctional Service of Canada does the best that they can with mentally ill offenders. They have a number of psychiatric centers, but you know, they're still prisons, and I would say they're prisons first before they are mental health facilities. And I say that quite openly and candidly. It is a huge problem in this country, and I don't know, despite having a mental health commission, a mental health this, a mental health that, I haven't seen a lot of action. I've seen a lot of words. So it's, you know, and it creates challenges for the parole board. You can imagine the difficulty of trying to have a hearing with someone who is not mentally well. And if you were someone as a board member, you're probably going to deny that release because you're really not understanding that person very well. So it's a really tough one.
Well, I have actually two things. One is clarification. When you described recidivism, you were very, very clear that people who qualify for day parole, who are the cream of the crop, don't offend 98% to the end of their sentence. I wasn't sure whether you said people who also qualify for conditional release at, you know, after, you know, whatever time it takes them to qualify. They also have about 98% success?
Day parole is 99%, and full parole is 98%, and statutory release, because those are the ones who have not applied for day parole, have been denied full parole. Those are the ones that are kind of, you know, if you're going to be scared of, those are probably the most ones that you're going to be scared of. Or the ones that say, you know what, I don't want day parole, I don't want full parole, I'll stand on my head and do this time. Those are what we sort of kind of call the rounders. Because they might be doing a life sentence by the installment plan. Those people have a less, obviously, and they should have, less success rate. And I think it's somewhere, I don't have the exact rate with me, but I think it's somewhere in the 60% that they don't, 60% of them will complete their sentence successfully, so it's a lot lower.
Okay, and so when we hear of repeat offenders, are those people who sometimes
when the sentence is over, then reoffend? Or is it mostly these people who have not had a supervised reentry?
Well, those people who are released at two-thirds, the ones that they're still being supervised.
Yes,
they're,
I understand.
The people who are reoffending, I would hope that that would include those people who are currently under supervision, but also who have recently perhaps finished their sentence successfully. I mean, that would still count as a reoffending, even though they're not currently right. under sentence.
Right. No, I'm just curious because you do read a lot about repeat offenders, but in fact, it sounds like when you think of, as you say, the kind of people who are in the system, many from very disadvantaged backgrounds, they seem actually to be coming out of prison and being reintegrated successfully.
Well, I think they are. And if you look at the numbers of who's coming into our prison system, our penitentiary system, it's not the people who are on parole. It's new offenders, which gets back to, you know, that whole thing. It's, you know, a lot more effective to prevent criminal behavior. It's a lot cheaper to prevent criminal behavior. And it's another, like mental health, that we're not doing enough on the crime prevention side. And I think we don't do a lot because, you know, it takes probably a generation to see your results. And, you know, when most mandates are, you know, 4 or 5 years, that's a bit too far out to start investing the money that's needed for the results that you want a generation from now.
Sorry, if I could just completely change track here. I found it interesting you said that people are, nobody can tell the parole board what to do. They're picked, they're representative of Canadian society. And yet, when we were tough on crime, the parole board was tough on crime, and elder hearings for Indigenous fell. Could we conclude from that either that there was some kind of bias in the appointment process that we might face again with a government that was tough on crime? Or is the parole board, being human, somewhat susceptible to those bad headlines?
I would say that the government of the day, and the government of the day always, you know, it's them who does the final appointment, their governor and council appointments. So I would say, despite having a fairly robust hiring process, you know, once you send, and I'm on every interview with every prospective parole board member, as are a lot of other people around the table, but once you send your list of final candidates up, somehow, somewhere up there, they choose, and, you know, so they do have some say in who's actually going to be on that board. So is it bias? I'm not sure I'd go so far as bias, but yeah, there's a filter.
Hi. The speaker last time, Mary Campbell, mentioned that the review period between parole hearings was increased by the previous government. I think it's 5 years or some, possibly 5 years, between review periods, if I'm not mistaken. I'm wondering if this change in policy of the Conservative government, because you've obviously been involved for a longer period in that, has affected the parole process, or your comments on that in general.
Sorry, can you repeat that? I'm not quite sure I understood the...
I was here for the last speaker...
It helps if you hold the mic a little...
Sorry, I'm sorry.
Oh, much better.
Hold it this way.
Okay.
Can
you hear me now? Okay, great, super. So the last speaker who appeared before the Compassionate Justice Series, Mary Campbell, mentioned that the period between the opportunity for review of parole had increased under the previous government. So I'm just curious to know what the implications are, how that has changed the parole process, that it takes a much longer time for federal inmates, once they've been turned down and once they've reached a decision, to have their decision... have another opportunity to appear before the parole board.
Yeah. Yes. So what you're referring to is that if someone is denied parole, they now have to wait at least a year before they can reapply. In some cases, 5 years, I think, depending on the crime. Unless something happens, So let's say, just as an example, someone gets denied parole because they haven't finished some program that they were supposed to do or whatever. Now, the board, if they're smart, won't deny. They'll adjourn the process and say, when you're finished, let's come back and talk to us. Because if they deny that release, then they're going to, that person may have to wait a year. If that person has a really good case management team, though, because that case management team, the people inside working, can actually come back to the board and say, you know, he's supposed to wait a year, but here's what's happened. He's finished this program, blah, 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 blah. And the parole board could then consider whether to review again within that one-year period. So it's not a hard rule. But it's a rule that if you're that case management team and you just, you know, well, we'll just wait, you know, you just kind of put that in your BF system, your bring forward system, and you know, you kind of forget about it. So that's the problem. But yes, it doesn't help to have those hard or soft lines.
Good afternoon. I would like to zero in on the word offender that we've been generally using. And I want to discuss or ask you a question in regards to percentages of sexual offenders within both provincial and federal. Within the system, the relapse prevention program is being used, and it is being used outside in the community. My question is, are we finding more re-offenders coming from the federal, where it's being used with inside the system, or are we finding more re-offending when it is being used outside in the community?
On the provincial side, you know what? I don't have numbers for the provincial side. I don't. The Ontario Parole Board here paroled, I think, less than 300 people last year. So I'm not sure, you know, in terms of sex offenders who get provincial sentences, you know, less than 2 years. I'm assuming most of that programming is done on the outside. Funnily enough, and just more generally, we know that most programs are much more effective when they're delivered in the community. That's what the research says. With sex offenders in the federal system, they have quite a number of very different programs for, because a sex offender is not a sex offender is not a sex offender. There's all sorts of different types of sexual offending, and there's different programs for different types of sexual offenders, and we have certainly more different success rates and failure rates in the community for those different types of sex offenders. But any sex offender who has done programming on the inside would likely be expected to continue with that programming in the community.
Does the parole board mandate that the extended program within the community upon release?
We can, as a special condition. It would be to continue to follow, whether it be psychological counseling, whether it be a specific programming, we can. It would depend on what is being put forward, recommended by the various professionals who are dealing with that particular offender.
Thank you. I have one more question. How much of your own spirituality falls into your job?
Oh, good one. Now I'm going to have to tell you all that my ex-husband is an Anglican priest. So I spent quite a lot of time during my years in the church with my kids. Arriving here today was kind of interesting because my first church that I went to, I'm from Toronto way back, was St. Clement's just down the street here. And I was kind of surprised to see that I was back in this old neighborhood. So I would say, yes, quite a lot. Yeah.
I have a question about the system of pardons. and the role that you play in that, and understanding that the previous government in its time had changed those rules, and the present government said it was going to do something about pardons, and wondering where that's at.
Oh, yeah. Really great question. I'm glad you brought that up. Our pardon system is, quite frankly, in a real mess right now. So we had a pardon system, and then the previous government changed that. They didn't like the word pardon because somehow it was somehow related to forgive. I don't know why they didn't like it. But anyways, the government changed it to be called record suspensions. So we're going to suspend your record just like we do with a pardon. So the same result but a different name. And much different, much tougher timelines to when you can apply for a record suspension. But what happened is that a couple of people appealed that record suspension process, and the courts found it unconstitutional. So, and that was in Ontario and BC. So right now in the parole board, we deal with... Well, we deal with actually four different programs, four different pieces of legislation. So we deal with the old pardon system for Ontario and BC. We deal with the record suspension legislation for the rest of the provinces because no one has yet put an appeal forward in those provinces. And then we also have recently the government enacted the their historically unjust act, I think it was. It was all to do with the LGBT community in terms of those people who had been found guilty of same-sex, consensual same-sex acts. So we have an expungement process for that. So you can imagine my people working in Ottawa and trying to figure out which stream everyone fits into whenever they're applying for this. So you're right. The government did, in the early days of this government, did quite a huge consultation. I was retired at the time, so I was part of that consultation, filling in my online thoughts. And there was lots of work done, and nothing has happened. And I doubt anything will happen in the time period between now and a next election, because no one wants to be seen as being soft on crime. And I really think that we as citizens need to start to demand from our elected officials that, you know, I don't want to hear whether you're soft on crime. I don't want to hear whether you're tough on crime. I want to know what works and what keeps me safe. So.
We have time for possibly one more question. Is that CBC type back there?
Not in that capacity. You mentioned that women were one of your priorities in looking at some changes there. And obviously, with your background as Deputy Commissioner of Women in the past, can you explain a little bit more of what your thoughts are about having different kind of hearings for women than for men?
Yeah, I would say that because women, and one, they, women are completely different from men. Surprise, surprise. And we know that women have very different pathways into crime. They don't come into crime the same way as men do. They have 90%, over 90% of them have experienced some kind of physical or sexual abuse. So there's a lot of trauma in their lives. There's a lot of trauma in male offenders too, but much more predominant for women. And in terms of envisioning a different type of parole hearing, this is an area where actually I was surprised Canada's kind of not leading, because a lot of the states, believe it or not, I don't usually hold them up as a sign of progressive stuff when it comes to criminal justice, but in this, there's a few states that are doing parole hearings different for women. And by being different, I think it means for the case management team that's working with that woman to say, how do you want your parole hearing to happen? Do you want it set up as that traditional, you're on this side of the desk and the parole board is on this side of the desk and, you know, very formal? Do you want it less formal? How we question. Normally we question at a parole hearing, we start with the index offense or the offense that they're actually in prison for, and we'll start with that. Well, for women, that might really just start right from the get-go, re-trigger trauma. And so we wonder why she doesn't talk to us anymore. Well, maybe we should start a little bit different and couch it in different ways and come to that. Once she's feeling pretty good about, you know, what about being comfortable and being open, because that's, I mean, the parole hearing, that's what you want. You want the offender to be as open as possible so that you can get a good idea of whether they really understand, you know, why they're in prison and talk about it and what they've done and what they plan to do on their release. But with women, it's probably not the best way to start. You know, we might want to start on a more positive, so what are your plans, and work our way backwards. But we have, and I'm just saying that we're actually looking at it right now in terms of doing some research and seeing what other jurisdictions are doing. But, you know, it's, I'm thinking it would be something like that.
Time for one more question.
Hi there.
Hi.
I think the initial comments in this presentation based on media sensationalism, I think... So the comments on media sensationalism, I think out of most of the comments made in your presentation should be, by and large, one of the bigger takeaways. And I think that viewing different articles and different news reports on its face without really knowing what actually happened behind them is a peril. I think it's quite dangerous. And I'm actually a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, and I've spent the next probably 6 or 7 years of my life reviewing the parole board and parole grant rates, and in some instances critiquing it. And in the past 2 years, I've spoken to, I would say, the academic superstars in the parole field. Anthony Doob is one of them. Rosemary Gartner and Kelly Hannah Moffitt, who deals a lot with actuarial tools. And I can say, by and large, that the research that we've been doing that has been peer-edited and reviewed is showing that incarceration actually really isn't a place for people to be. And eligibility at one-third of a sentence is diminishing the confidence of some people in this room and in our population. But I think that's a little unfounded and not really entrenched in our evidence. But I'm telling you what my concern is. My concern is that people are being released cold turkey from maximum security prisons into the community at statutory release, because parole grant rates are decreasing and most inmates are being released at statutory release. And they're actually not being released at one-third because they're not applying at one-third, because they haven't finished their programming. So what I'd like to know is there anything being done to accelerate people being enrolled in programming earlier in their sentence rather than later?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I would challenge you on the parole grant rates decreasing. They are increasing. They have over the past couple of years. And you know, I think largely because of, you know, some of the recognition that people should be released in a timely way, in a structured way, in you know, under supervision. In terms of whether or not they have anyone being released from a maximum security on stat release is frightening, should be frightening to us all. But sometimes that's, and the parole board doesn't have anything to do with that. I mean, that's something you'd have to take up with the Correctional Service of Canada. But, you know, sometimes that's the best they can do with some offenders. I hate to say that. A lot of people spend a lot of time in maximum security and never, unfortunately, cascade down. But that's not always the fault of the people working within the system. What was your question about programming? How can we... Yeah, we're working... I'm going to tell you, Commissioner Kelly, who was recently appointed as the new commissioner, has a very, very ambitious mandate letter that she received after her appointment. But she also comes from the community. She was a parole officer around the same time I was a parole officer. So we go a long ways back. We've had a few good chats. She is hugely committed to reintegration. So I'm expecting that, and so we're working together quite a bit, so I'm expecting that she will help turn a large ship around. It's going to take a long time to have a better focus on reintegration and ensure that, you know, people are getting their programs. That being said, there's no reason why the parole board shouldn't be granting parole to someone who may have not finished a program, if that program can be continued in the community, you know, and if they think that actually, you know, their risk is such that even if they're, you know, halfway through it or whatever, that that can still be viable in the community. So I would hope that just on that alone, that parole board members are not denying